Scott, thank you very much for sitting with us. As we've discussed ahead of time, this is going to be a conversation mostly centered on spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking. But to get to that period, we have a few lead-up questions. And in particular, wanted to first understand, where did your interest in physics come, and how did you get to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics?
Well, I've always followed the path of most interest and least resistance, and that seemed to be physics. When I went to a pretty good high school. It was a private day school in the town where I grew up, Wilmington, Delaware, and they had a more than adequate science program. I didn't benefit from much biology, but we had good chemistry and physics and an excellent couple of math teachers, one of whom promised that next year he was going to teach us how to solve cubic equations, but then he died. So I never did learn how to solve cubic equations, but I know where to look it up. And that got me into Princeton. I got to Princeton, and in the first year, I took maximal rate physics, math, chemistry, and electrical engineering. And electrical engineering was so boring that I dropped it after one term, but I kept on, and chemistry after 1 year. But so I did physics and math and English literature and German and all the things that you can do in college. And when it was time to apply to grad school, I was an experimentalist who was at least competent at doing theory, and that got me into Harvard. Once I got to Harvard, I became a theorist because I realized you could do experiments on computers. And so that's how I got to do a thesis on effective medium theories of interesting alloys, the same alloys, copper manganese, for example, copper with some manganese, iron and manganese and nickel, mixed magnetic systems that were subsequently in certain ranges of dilution were discovered to be spin glasses. But I went from a world in which, the man's dead now, so I can give you my unbiased opinion of him without burning any bridges. Henry Ehrenreich, whom I worked for, was kind of a excellent at what he did, but low status physicist. And in order to build the status of the subjects he was interested in, which were metals and alloys, he had to make the alloys look like metals, meaning that they had to be described by an effective field theory or effective medium theory. And in order to have the necessary mathematical sophistication to go to have tea with Julian Schwinger and Paul Martin and people like that, we had to use Green's functions for everything. So it took a number of years for me to realize that some of this was decorative and not entirely necessary. And I sort of developed a taste for doing things on the computer that were like the experiments that you couldn't really adequately characterize in theory. And that's how I got into, I went off to work with Marl Cohen at Chicago. And Marl was interested in glasses, semiconducting chalcogenides, things like that. Ovshinsky materials that might have interesting applications. And it was sort of a move from needing a uniform model of everything to appreciating the interesting things that happen when the inhomogeneities are the dominant feature And the characteristics you want to extract are the points at which an inhomogeneity dominates the homogeneous behavior, creates something different. So when I was at Chicago, Marl Cohen one day suggested that I read some, every now he would toss us papers. He suggested that I should read a paper on percolation. And I had a grad student I was working with, and we decided we would, this was pretty interesting, we would try to read some more and, I don't know, maybe have a seminar or something. We ended up writing a widely read and more readable than its predecessor's review paper in Annals of Physics, or I forget even where it appeared, but this was... oh gosh, the kid has died. He went off into finance and did very well by himself. And I've forgotten his last name. At any rate, we wrote a well-read paper on percolation that had a handful of, you know, milli insights of things that we hadn't seen in the literature, and it was readable. And it helped to recognize that percolation had interesting things to add, but it wasn't the whole world, because percolation did not explain Anderson localization. So at that time, the giants were Phil Anderson, Pierre Degen, and I would say the midgets who were, you know, trying to hang out with the giants and maybe grow up to be giants themselves were people like John Simon. And Degen insisted, coming from polymers and other mechanical and chemical things, Degen insisted on trying to understand localization thresholds, Anderson localization, from a standpoint of percolation, which doesn't work, misses the subtlety and the suddenness with which it snaps up, it steps up on you. And I would say Simon managed to be more or less, from what I would regard as my old advisor, Ehrenreich's community of turning everything into a uniform description, if you like, averaging too early. So I got a really nice education in the course of grad school and a postdoc in the different ways you could approach inhomogeneous problems and some of the pitfalls you could fall into. And then I came to IBM, and
so just before we jump there, so you mentioned that you were using computers already a lot during your thesis and your postdoc work. So was this the main instrument? What was the balance of work, and what sort of computational resources did you have at your disposal at that point?
My thesis was half analytic and half computational. The computational part was to reduce final expressions to curves, not to simulate at great depth. I probably simulated a few things at Chicago. So at Harvard, we had a 7094 in the basement, and you went to the basement of what was just beginning to be a computer science department, and you punched cards on an 029 key punch. And you could get pretty good at that. Sebastian Doniak was around. I remember he was the only faculty member I would ever see spending the night in the computer key punch room, you know, because if you hung out down there, you could get three runs in a night instead of only one. The stuff would come back as having failed the first two times, and you could fix things. So I did spend a little time in that era, and I moved on to stuff. I go back even further than that. I actually worked with one of the dawn of the modern era computers as a undergraduate in a summer job, I worked at a company in Cambridge that had a drum memory machine with instructions which you optimized by knowing how long each instruction took, and then using the second half of an instruction pair to branch to the point that would be just underneath the read head on the memory drum. And this was great fun. This was as complicated as programming GPUs is today. So I guess I've always loved that particular kind of math puzzle, and we had plenty of it.
So you're saying you went to IBM. So was it computer driven, or took you to IBM?
Oh, what took me to IBM was working on the phase properties, overall properties, the physical properties of random materials. I joined the physical sciences department in their theory group. I forget, I was in and out of the theory group and experimental groups for a while. So I was in both kinds of groups. I managed a low temperature physics group that had Richard Webb and Dick Voss, both doing really interesting early, I'd say middle stage Josephson Junction work at one point.
Okay. My initial
assignments were things like theory of random magnets, spin waves in random magnets. I can't say that I solved any of the world's problems, but it was a good introduction. And it was an introduction to people who made crucibles full of interesting substances. Ours were Fred Holzberg and Steve von Molnar and Tom Penny. And at Bell Labs, you had Bernd Matthias and a couple of other people who could produce things that were either purer than anybody else thought possible or had small concentrations of things that nobody else would have thought to put there, which allowed you to, to make dope semiconductors and RKKY coupled magnets, which is where spin glasses got started. Long range coupling with random signs between spins in magnetic systems were a natural extension of the stuff for which I did very, very approximate band theories as a grad student. And I went on beyond that, continued that area for some time as a postdoc and at IBM.
So your work on percolation at IBM was mostly secondary to your main responsibilities, or because it was an important part of your early publication record?
Well, about the time I finished up at Chicago and came to IBM, I did a really nice paper on, I was at a conference in Michigan where David Thouless and a student had explored how, let's say you make a simulated percolating system by punching holes in a sheet of conducting paper, and you measure the conductance of that sheet of paper. How does it go to zero? Does it go to zero with the same sharp, an exponent less than one as the percolation exponents? And the answer is no, the exponent is greater than one, it's got a long tail, and it's clearly affected by the local geometry through which the current flows. And so I had a little FizzRev, on the way back, fortunately I wasn't driving. So on the way back from Ann Arbor to Chicago, I wrote a program in my head, and I had a FizzRev letter with a mean field theory, a simple simulation of the threshold, and there was a third part. I forget how I got three things out of it, but I had a letter off by the end of the following week. And when I got to IBM, it was something that caught the attention of Rolf Landauer, who was the guy who best understood where De Gennes had gone wrong in thinking about Anderson localization, because he understood quantum mechanics plus, he understood how wave interference could accumulate in his case, one-dimensional narrow channels. And so one of the cool things about IBM was I could take these things that I was thinking about as Ising models and percolation models and ask, were they relevant for 5 micron wide strips of aluminum on the surface of a chip somewhere, because IBM would care. And so it was a great environment for operating, thinking about random systems on a scale just large enough to be interesting and small enough to be where the technology was at that point.
So was the quality of computers at IBM also a draw? Was significantly better than what you could get elsewhere, or it was roughly the same?
Oh, everybody had them. I got more and more interested in computers at IBM. I just used them. When in Chicago, I would have to ride out to Argonne in order to hang out and get 3 runs a night rather than 1 a night. And so computers were an obstacle for most of that time. At IBM, you could really do some things with them. Except you have to scale your expectations down. Raj Reddy at Carnegie Mellon around that time set as his goal for the decade of something like the 70s, to have a megapixel in his display and a megabyte of memory and a MIP. The MIPS moved along faster. I think they got to 10 MIPS fairly quickly. But, you know, this was all 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude below where we operate on our laptops today.
Sure, absolutely. So it's in that context that, as we mentioned earlier, I read your piece for Phil Anderson's 90th birthday. When you said that you read the EA paper, the Edwards Anderson paper, as soon as David Sherrington showed up at IBM for the summer of 75. Mm-hmm. So how did you get to know David Sherrington? And how did you get to discuss this particular problem with him? And he how did this up. Come about?
He came for the summer.
So you didn't know him beforehand?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so. I probably recognized his name, but I hadn't worked with him before. He was a student of Sam Edwards. Mm-hmm. And he'd gone off to, I don't know if he was at Oxford then or he got to Oxford later after he got famous, but he was probably at, Edwards was at Birmingham or Bristol. Since I haven't been to either, I'm not really clear on which ones. I think David was working at Manchester when he got started. But anyway, he kept in touch with Sam Edwards, and Edwards was telling him what he and Phil Anderson had done. A lot of stuff at the industrial labs got done. Things got a more academic flavor every summer because we'd have a lot of visitors. And so David came to IBM and walked around the theory group. And I must have been pointed out to him as somebody who could put things on the computer and ask questions about it. And he had the idea that at the roughly the stage that I described in the paper, that we could take the analytical path that Sam Edwards had followed with Phil, but turn it into a spherical model. In fact, an Ising Erdős-Reényi graph model rather than a spherical model with squishy spins. And off we went. And neither of us is the world's greatest mathematician, so we just went down that path enough times to be convinced that we knew how the theory would work out.
So when
and,
did
my contribution was to calculate some stuff when we were all done.
So when did computers play a role, if at all, in these early stages for you?
Oh, well, we started modeling enough stuff to recognize, enough to test whether the predictions for internal energy as a function of temperature for specific heat measured from fluctuations in Monte Carlo, whether those would be reasonable or not.
Okay.
So I'm trying to think. I did a whole bunch of papers with Brooks Harris at Penn on a proper theory of random insulating magnets, and I'm just trying to think of whether was that all algebra, or did we simulate anything for that? I suspect we didn't simulate anything. I think we just wrote out equation after equation. So this was probably the first extensive simulations that I found myself doing.
Okay. So this was already that summer, or during that 6 month visit, that you were doing simulations contemporaneously as you were writing the paper?
Well, the first paper was a PhysRev letter, and mm-hmm. then the second one was a PhysRev with all sorts of numerical results in it. The letter, we had to do a certain amount of numerical work to get numbers out of the equations that the formalism gave us. And so it was not obvious from, you could derive things at t equals zero and you could derive things at tc, but in between you had to solve equations that were kind of ugly and that required iteration on a computer. So that was my piece. And I should get a little credit for recognizing that if we pushed all the way to the entropy, you might not have wanted to bother with the entropy, because who's going to measure that? Well, if we went to the entropy, we found something that wasn't zero, as it should have been, but was a small negative number. And that's what got our little piece of the field started, because we wrote a paper that said, this is all totally consistent above the threshold. It predicts there is a phase, and the characteristics of the phase in this theory are not trustworthy. And we, therefore, were asking for lots of citations.
So talking about...
I recommend to students today.
So you can you tell us, in that context, actually, the immediate reception to that work? How did the news of it spread, for instance?
Basically, we said there really is a spin glass phase, and it could very well, in this simple model, be delineated by a sharp transition, and experiments have been showing sharp transitions, however, a transition that is very much sensitive to how you approach it and how long you stay there, and has all sorts of hysteresis complications that I guess we now understand to be part of the fact that there are just many states that that these things have access to, like any glassy system. But the fact that experimentalists really like the fact that the pictures they've been drawing now had some theoretical substrate. Whereas over the years, the theorists have enjoyed the fact that the mean field theories we create now have an exact, rigorous theoretical substrate. So these things take time.
Okay, so there was not a surge of enthusiasm right as the paper came out. It took some time for it to be digested. Is that your impression?
Well, I would say it was a well-received paper, both by theorists and experimentalists. And while we had to admit that our conclusions had inconsistencies, physics is full of problems that people work on that they can't solve, but they still publish. Look at high-energy physics.
So shortly, I mean, the next summer, you attended the 1976 Aspen Summer Workshop entitled Current Topics in the Theory of Condensed Matter, which had a number of spinning glass people attending as well, including Anderson, Thouless, Toulouse. So can you tell us more about the discussions that were taking place from the theory side at that point?
Well, in terms of what I was trying to understand, and it did turn out to be fundamental, basically the old timers like Phil knew about extensions, they knew about the gradual extensions to mean field theory that in this context eventually became cavity approaches, ways of posing a mean field theory not as a solution of everything at one point, but one point with a surround that acts on it, which you then iterate to reach a self-consistent description of a spin or an electron or an object of some sort in a random environment made up of objects like it. So that's a richer sort of what are still mean field theories, because you're desperately trying to characterize a complicated system by just a very few points that you hope are typical. And that's what I spent the time at Aspen trying to understand. And the TAP equations, which were cavity equations, came out of that. And it was really David Thouless who probably had the deepest understanding of it all. And a little bit later, he was able to come up with the Almeida-Thouless line, which was where the Edwards-Anderson type theory broke down.
So
and that was the first example. I don't even know if that's a replica symmetry breaking line. I suspect it is, because the words that go with it and the physical intuition is that's the point where a stationary phase, the assumption that you can solve by looking at derivatives, the Hessian around a single point characterizes, you know, all of the corrections, that breaks down along that line.
So you were saying that you were, that summer, you spent a lot of time thinking about cavity equations, and the TAP equations is what came out of it. But was it a very collective discussion of, can you describe us the ambience of how those conversations went, and why is it TAP in the end and not TAPS? Or
why wasn't I part of it? I don't know. Probably because I would say my contributions were much more what intuition are we heading for, rather than, you know, any of the equations that got written down in the paper. Richard Palmer was also there. I would say he and I were mostly trying to put things into words so that they made sense to us. And if they made sense to us, maybe then we'd sit down. And the others had solved it before we got to the point where it made sense to us. But we participated.
Okay, so it was a very fluid discussion group, as you were suggesting.
Yeah, I would say that increasingly, and in subsequent work, I took my contribution to be, hey, I can really make a model of this and put it on a computer and simulate it and do some of the experiments that you're trying to characterize. And we'll see if your mean field theory and my slightly more extended model are talking about the same phenomena.
I see.
And so I've continued to, you know, I only stayed in the field for, you know, at the outside, you might say it was 10 years. And by 1980, I was already in a computer science group worrying about algorithms for designing computers. So this was a fairly short period for me, but it was a great deal of fun. And I really, miss the people that I was able to work with during that time.
So another meeting was the 1978 Les Ouches Summer School on ill condensed matter, where you were one of lecturers.
Yep.
How influential do you think this school was, and how can you describe us your impressions of it?
Well, the there was a lot of experimental material. There was, I basically spent my lectures describing the things that I could do experiments on and characterizing how well you could learn from those experiments and what their limits were. And so, of course, you go forward 10, 20, 40 years, and you could do those experiments at an incredibly greater resolution, but you wouldn't learn too much more from them. So it was, I was really lucky in the time that I wrote that stuff up. Phil gave an overall perspective and talked about a whole lot more problems. So for Phil, the summer school was kind of, you know, from condo to the future. And the future, I'd have to go back and look at his notes to see where he felt the future was, because it was still vague enough that it hasn't adopted his nomenclature or his set of classic problems completely. And we had people working. Another reason why it was timely was there was a great series of talks on topology and what topology could constrain, what it could separate. And that has proved to be an ongoing theme in condensed matter and exotic states of matter ever since then. And we had one guy that was, you know, the Frenchmen all loved him. So they got Poincaré, who's probably a Romanian, who have given the name, but he was teaching at Ecole Normale or in the Parisian orbit. And what it established, that school established what you might think of as the Paris-Rome axis, because Parisi was there, but he was very young. There were other Romans, and Rome was where the French group that had started the school would send their students to do postdocs, and they would go themselves. To this day, I'm bad on last names when I have to retrieve them in a hurry. Give me the guy who's now the president of Ecole Normale.
Mézard.
Yeah. Okay. Marc Mézard was probably the person who crystallized the Paris-Rome axis. And to this day, he prefers speaking Italian at dinner to speaking English or French. I would say that the thing that I would say is the greatest accomplishment of that summer school was forging a community to which all sorts of smart Europeans would gravitate over time. Germans, Czechs like Lenka, and her husband, Florent, is not really a Czech. I think he's probably a Serb. But Eastern Europeans would make French. Their way to Paris and off to Switzerland and Rome and places like that. And that's what these European-funded summer schools were supposed to do, and it's worked.
So actually, I think Florent is French, and he did his postdoc in Rome, so he's really one of the examples of people that went back and forth between Paris and Rome.
Yeah.
So during that 5-year period where you're most active on spin glasses, how closely were you following the theoretical discussions on mean field, like the work on Bray and Moore, of Blandin, of Rudnick and Pitta, for instance?
Only somewhat.
Okay.
And it's because I kept applying as a test for whether this was something I should get involved in. Can I make it happen on a computer? Watch it and see if there's something they've missed. Did they get it right? And are there things they've missed?
I did
a couple of papers which were the experiments to go with. For example, I did a paper on percolation theory in 2 to 6 dimensions. And I also looked at spin glasses in various dimensions as the argument, which is still unsettled between, if you like, a corrupted first order transition and a true spin glass transition in three dimensions and four dimensions, if you want. I was looking for an experimental means of shedding some light on the influence of dimension on these things. In percolation theory, it works. You can learn a lot. You can get exponents that are accurate and believable and interesting. In spin glasses, it's harder because you need to wait for the dynamics to settle down and you need to take averages rather than just do geometric measurements.
Yeah, so I wanted to, actually, this is exactly where I wanted to go, talking about that 1976 work of yours on higher dimensions. I think you might be the first person to consider higher dimensions in numerical work. Is that correct? Am I?
Probably I'm not, but certainly I had, at that point, I had better computing power available to me. And people with even more, like Los Alamos, hadn't gotten interested in the problem. So I had the field to myself for a year or 6 months or something like that.
And in the spin glass, another simulation group that looked at the role of dimension is Binder's group. When Stauffer and Binder wrote a paper in 1979, looking at the role of dimensionality in spin glasses, a bit like you did. How did you?
They probably did a better job than I did too, because I was doing other stuff by then.
Okay. So you were not paying close attention to what was going on at that point.
Yeah, I confess I did one thing at a time and I did my thing each time. And if it worked, I published it. And if it didn't, I moved on to do something else. And I ended up, I would say the last couple of years during the time I was working on the simulated annealing paper, probably from the paper appeared in 81, but a lot of it was written from 79 to 80. That was a time when Dan Gillette and I were working very hard on applying iteration schemes that were not straight downhill minimization to design of frustrated engineering problems. And so in the course of explaining to, Dan's job was to explain things to engineers and my job was to explain things to the math department so they would realize we were working on something interesting. And we ended up teaching them about the importance of frustration in making problems, non-single minimum. They would have subsidiary minima, and the annealing analogy was Gillette's. He had an even better gift for good words than I did. So. He never got proper credit for that because he left at his father's command to take over charge of a couple of companies that his family owned back in Wisconsin. Dan and I together with the help of some programmers in Poughkeepsie transferred simulated annealing code to IBM's design automation team that supported what we would now think of as FPGA design or more unconstrained, you put the circuits where you want, but they're circuits from a library, not full custom design. So library-based design, which is the way chips are designed to this day, full custom went out a couple of generations ago as just unworkable and unreliable. And so you had to put these little blocks down with all sorts of rules, if you like, highly constrained optimization, but there's so much stuff and there's so many different ways you can do it that it becomes a combinatorially marginal to intractable problem. So I spent those years in the business of solving intractable problems other than spin glasses, with spin glasses, if you like, as a poster child for what sorts of interesting things could happen, what stuff to avoid, all that kind of thing. So they were just an inspiration to us, but we made money for IBM and got some bonuses out of it by making it possible for IBM to put a computer on fewer chips than if they hadn't had our software.
So
and we also, the other thing that I keep trying to pass on to people was that life in research trying to influence engineering is endlessly frustrating in itself. I had this happen at least twice in my IBM career. So the first time was transferring programs to Poughkeepsie. I wrote a gorgeous long 6-page Fortran program that did simulated annealing for a highly simplified circuit placement problem. And we transferred it to a programmer who took it apart and, using the best methodology of the day, split it up into a single page, no routine longer than a single page, everything easily understandable by people less smart than she was. And that's what we were able to transfer. When we certified that our 6-page long, more than 1,000 lines of Fortran was functionally equivalent to her, you know, carefully boiled down and separated code, they accepted it and went off to use it. They found it was slow, so they rewrote it as 6 pages of Fortran. And everything to do with getting stuff across to engineering that I've been part of or watched since then has had to do with boiling down the ideas to where they can be accepted one at a time and then watching them get put back together into something nobody who didn't do it themselves could understand. Anyway, so IBM was great for that kind of observation about the real world.
So could you tell us more about the genesis of this idea, how you went from spinning glass to optimization? Where did that insight come from?
Well, it was very simple. The question was, we had a prediction of the ground state energy of a spin glass. And I could put a spin glass on the computer, but to find its ground state energy, I had to cool it to its ground state.
Okay.
Well, how are you going to do that? You do it slowly. If you try, I mean, you immediately discover that the natural greedy algorithm gets stuck, and so you try to get it unstuck, and you heat it, and you, after a while, you learn that you apply heat at all stages in the approach to the ground state, and you watch through observing fluctuations, you watch the susceptibility and the specific heat as you're doing so.
And the mapping to computer architecture problem, was this because you were learning about this yourself being at IBM, or was it through the conversations with your co-authors, or?
Oh, I like computers. And so I was spending some time, both Gillette and I were spending a little time trying to learn how computers were designed, and we found that in research there were a very small number of computer design gurus, and each guru had one trick. The problem was the source of frustration in computer design is, if you want stuff to be as fast as possible, you want to put the pieces together as close together as possible. And when you do, they heat the silicon and they go outside of temperature bounds and they stop working. And so you have, and furthermore, if you try to space them out, you need wires, you need wiring, these little copper aluminum alloy strips. And there isn't a lot of space for the wires. So you have a fight to make space for the wiring. You have a fight to keep things cool enough so that they'll run correctly. In research, we tended to design to zero tolerance, and then we would turn it over to engineers who knew that if you didn't have, you know, many sigma of tolerance, your computers wouldn't work and the customers would send them back and you'd all get fired. So it was interesting to learn to operate in that world. Now, the gurus would boil the problem down to its simplest form and say, Brad Dunham, for example, was a guru. He would say, your problem is you want to squeeze it together for performance and you want to pull it up and you want to have room for the wiring channels. So first squeeze it together as hard as you can and then stop with the solution and then pull it just far enough apart to make room for the wiring channels and that will cool it off. And the idea that you could do both at the same time was not in their mindscape, not in their vision. And the second thing that if you're a guru, you can have an excellent career in IBM and get awards and, you know, trips to nice places to receive the awards and bonuses and things like that. They didn't get a bigger office. You had to be a manager to get a bigger office, but you could be highly regarded if you had a good idea and you had a handful of disciples to whom you would teach the good idea and they would go out and do it in the development laboratories. But if you were too clear about your good idea, then everybody could do it and you'd have to have another good idea and that's hard. And so I found the gurus tended to be a little bit mystical and not very good as educators. And Gillette and I realized that what we wanted to do was do everything at once, but under the control of an objective function, which like a Hamiltonian would normalize all the things you were trying to do so you could do more of them in terms of managing an energy or some cost function or some other overall thing. So that's really where spin glasses came in. Spin glasses have Hamiltonians. They have all sorts of random couplings and you just can't do everything at once. And if you want to think simply and clearly about a spin glass, you isolate the frustration between ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic tendencies or domain walls between regions that are organized well, but you can only do that up to a certain scale, and then you put energy in a domain wall. And so you then have to look at shortening the domain walls or reducing the tensions in the domain walls. So conceptually, things can be looked at locally, but in terms of optimization, things have to be looked at globally by iterating everywhere. And that's kind of back in fashion in spin glass modeling in these parallel simulated annealing and many replica approaches to solving models of spin glasses and other models of problems in combinatorics that have the same characteristics of spin glasses of being inherently hard and ugly and requiring an extended non-local approach. But you think about them simply in terms of replica symmetry breaking and phase boundaries and all the old ideas.
So we will get back to that just before.
Have I left the galaxy? I'm sorry.
No, absolutely not. This is perfect. But some work you were doing at the same time. There's still a few works on spinning glasses that happened in the early 80s, including a paper with Peter Young and another couple of papers with Nihat Berker or Berker. What led to those works or what?
Oh, you know what? The area that I thought was insufficiently explored was using very simple recursion relations to identify flows, flows towards different kinds of order. And so with Nihat, for example, we were looking at random recursion relations following Give me the name. Who were the either one or two Russians who, gosh, it was a really cool, quick and dirty spatial recursion relations. The idea was to use spatial.
The gaskets, are you talking about the gaskets or?
No, that's a different one. That was a long battle I had with Gene Stanley on why was the threshold in conductivity different from the threshold in percolation. And Sierpinski gaskets were a nice model on which to look at. But my argument, Gene was sort of following a Degen line of thought, and he had a complicated prescription for what limited conductivity close to a percolation threshold. And my own theory was that the biconnected component of a random lattice was quite obviously the only place where current could flow, because it was the only place that could contact both the source and the sink of your current. That struck me as a nice thing to explore, and I did a paper on it, which got totally ignored by a larger group of people who had a more complicated model that used all the same words. And so I didn't have the time to pursue that, but I always felt that was kind of, a good idea that got left out. And it did explain why the exponents were changed, because it had totally different critical properties. I'm thinking of, there's a recursion relation that had two Russians. I was around that time, that was around the time of thinking about the XY model. What was different about the criticality in the XY model? There's a paper by Leo Kadanoff, Jorge Jose, David Nelson, and finally me. And we simulated the recursion relations for spatial recursion, spatial shrinking of an XY model. And to our surprise, it was absolutely straight for 32 decades of high precision IBM computing. But Leo pointed out that you could get that without ever going near a computer, which was humbling and impressive. But we thought both paths were interesting enough that we made a paper out of it. And around that time, Thaulis and Mike, he got his Nobel Prize.
Austerlitz.
Mike Austerlitz and David Thaulis pointed out that there was in fact a transition. You just had to work a little harder than Leo had. But we laid down much of the pathway. We just missed the path, the turnoff to the right solution at the end of that. And so, that was the same recursion relation that we were using, that I was using with Nihat Berker to study spin glasses. And what we would do is start with a random distribution of spins and interactions and shrink them to see if they flowed towards a critical point, and we could understand behavior in different dimensions that way. But it wasn't, I don't think we ran into computational limitations. I think it wasn't the right way to tackle that problem. I just remember once, I also was working with Gerard Toulouse during that time, and I was at École Normale, and they wanted me to give a seminar, and I said, which would you like to hear about? Migdal-Kadanoff recursions, it's Leo and Sasha Migdal were the names that went on the trick. Okay. Which would you like to hear about? Migdal-Kadanoff for random systems or simulated annealing? And they said, oh, Migdal-Kadanoff, please. And I just remember at that point, both Toulouse and I exchanging an unstated thought that this was not the most important subject of the, to, you know, to hear about, but if that's what they wanted, that's what they were going to hear.
So speaking of your work with Toulouse, you started working on more, less physical or more computational problem, like the traveling salesman problem with him in the mid 80s, right? You have a paper, I think, in...
Yeah, that was because there's a particular traveling salesman problem that's in the Parisi, Virasoro, and Mazard book. Parisi, Mazard, Virasoro. At any rate, the idea is this: you take n spins with n random distances between the random. It's a spherical model. It's a dimensionless model or an infinite dimensional model. You take n spins with random distances between them, and you try to find a single path with no repeats, returning to the origin at the end of a minimal distance, a traveling salesman path. And if you do it in a greedy way, you get a length that goes as log n. And if you do it in a smarter way, you can do it by Karp-Sipser type dissection, or lots of different ways, you'll get a constant. And so the question is, what should that constant be? And that's a problem. There are such powerful codes for solving traveling salesman problems that you can write your own and come up with a better code. There was a guy in my group down at IBM Hawthorne at that time, who later went over to Harold Stone. He later went to NEC and is probably retired now because he's older. He was older than me, and he was the kind of person who could, you know, in the shower he'd think of a clever way of doing a branch and bound or a branch and cut program with some elegant new feature to it. So he felt one day like writing a TSP program. So we had access to Harold's program, which for some reason was not very good at realistic TSPs, but was really good at the random distance TSP. And it was even better at asymmetric TSPs, in which the upper right and the lower right distances in the distance matrix did not have to be the same. I don't recall exactly what role Toulouse played in that, but it was something we talked about. And we were probably also talking about other problems at the same time. But I worked on that for a while. And subsequently, that is, I believe, solved by one RSB. I noticed in the paper that I had said that's a replica symmetric problem. I don't know to this day whether it really is has a replica symmetric solution. And the numbers in the Parisi, Virasoro, Mazard book are correct. But I was working for some time on with Harold's program, which was better than the other ones that were available, to see whether those numbers were right or not. They were almost right. And I went back a little while ago, and the numbers still don't seem right. But I've been told that it's been upheld by Talleyrand, and so therefore we shouldn't question it, that any problems in a numerical experiment are conditions of the size of the experiment or something like that. And I have never had the time to go get to the bottom of that one.
So did you follow other works that were on a similar theme, like Foo and Anderson, that took place at about that same time, or were you concerned with other problems?
Mostly with other problems, because by that time I had 50 people working for me, and we were making IBM's first tablet, which got shipped, by the way. That's an accomplishment I'm quite proud of. But during the time I was doing real engineering, see, I took Dan Gillat was briefly placed in, you know, in the real stuff side of research. Then he left to run his father's companies, and they gave me his job. And I thought computers were kind of interesting, and so I went over there and I spent another 15 years making stuff. And I would say the accomplishments were we made a couple of chips that were better than what they replaced. We had a small role in RISC architecture computers, and when we finally got things together, we produced a 8.5 by 11, you know, a pad of paper sized laptop that you could write on with a pen, and the ink would be displayed on the screen. And it would, we had two groups running in parallel. The speech group wanted to recognize cursive, and we discovered that we could much more easily recognize print. And we could see an application for filling out forms with printed letters that would probably be useful. And so IBM shipped it and sold it for a couple of years. And we went through the process that I described before. We created a prototype laptop. We took it down to Boca Raton, where they were at that time making personal computers. And they completely re-engineered it, threw out all of our choices of components, and over time found this problem and that problem and redid it. And it looked remarkably like our original design by the time they were ready to ship a product.
That's great.
So, but they had to go through that. That's how they learned how it worked. And we had terrible software problems, and IBM insisted on creating a version of OS2, which never really influenced much of the personal computing world. And at the same time, we were working with Go, which was a startup out in Foster City that I saw a lot of, that had an elegant looking interface, but they couldn't write code that worked. So they were not a great partner. And the thing that I learned that I'll just toss in for your enlightenment was that IBM had better all along this time. IBM and Bell Labs were at that time the place where really good work was getting done. And if you weren't teaching at a first-rate university, you wanted to be at one of those too. And I had friends at Bell Labs throughout that time who also were interested in making real stuff, like John Denker and Larry Jackall. And Larry Jackall, if you like, gave rise to Jan LeCun, who made real stuff and whom you're probably aware of. The AT&T people came in after we'd formed a relationship with Go, and our money had just about run out, and the Go software still didn't work for our laptop. So AT&T gave them lots of money. And that's about the point that we were ready to pull up and have nothing more to do with them. And Go read the contract carefully and discovered that we had said that if you get money from anybody else, you're going to give us our money back. So I learned something from that. We exited from Go with a lot of good ideas for a user interface, and we got all our money back. And AT&T ended up with basically funding their shutdown. So I had a really stimulating and interesting 15 years building real stuff at IBM, and I spent a little time on random systems, and some of the stuff that we built were in fact random systems, but it was a different world, and every bit is fascinating.
And you took, I think, a couple of...
Anyway, during that time, I did work, yeah.
So I said you took a couple of sabbatical leaves. during those years as well, right? One in Jerusalem and one in ENS. Is that right?
Well, I took a sabbatical. I spent a summer in Grenoble and ENS, but that was the summer of the Lesueux school. And I've had lots of visits.
Okay.
I'm comfortable settling in quickly and finding people to talk to in Rome, in Paris, nowadays in Lausanne. And there was a magnetism group in Grenoble who may be there to this day, but I was really only interacting with the experimental spin glass people during the time of the Lesueux school.
So,
The other reason for sabbaticals was very simple. My first marriage broke up in the late 1970s, early 80s. And in the mid 80s, I met my second wife, Daphna, who's Israeli. And after a couple of interesting postdocs and time that she spent at Phillips in Princeton and at MIT before that, no, MIT after that, and even some time at IBM, we ended up married with a couple of kids and returned to Israel. But I came to Israel on sabbatical during the latter part of the 90s, because at that point she'd taken up a tenure track position at the highest altitude available in the coolest weather in Israel.
So you've had a pretty broad exposure to both American and European science throughout your career. Can you explain to us?
Before we move on to these really big topics, let me give the time in Jerusalem credit for the fact that that was when Bart Selman and I were working on the question of whether a combinatorics problem had phase transitions, because Bart and his colleagues at Bell were the acknowledged masters of heuristic algorithms for solving KSAT. And KSAT has phase transitions. And I ended up working with Ricardo Zakina and
Monesson.
And Rémy Monesson on the whole question of phase boundaries in combinatorics, and the fact that the change between the easy problem in k equals 2 and the hard problem at k equals 3 occurred in mixed systems at k equals 2.6, which was later found to be because you could solve the two SAT problem. You could solve all the two clauses and the three clauses didn't matter up to 0.6, or maybe it's 0.4. I think it's 0.6. Okay. So we did a nice piece of work in the spin glasses and message passing part of the world, as late as the mid 90s. Because the field of spin glasses had broadened to include all of combinatorial optimization.
So this all stemmed out from your visit to Israel. I thought it had stemmed out from your visit to Paris. That's my confusion, I guess.
Oh, I was, the only time I was really based at ENS, I've probably made a bunch of visits there, but I hung out in Torino, and at that time, Ricardo's family's from Torino. He was at Trieste, but would come to Torino, and there was a center in Torino that I was invited to be on their advisory board and was for a number of years. And so there was work in Torino that led up to the 2+ PSAT and the 3SAT work with Rémy and Ricardo.
I see.
And so, yeah, I worked with them in Trieste, Paris, and Torino.
So throughout those years, you've been fairly well connected to the physics community, both on both sides of the Atlantic, right? And What did you feel was the American response? Because we've talked already about the European response, but what was the American response to ideas that came from spinning glasses and replica symmetry breaking, for instance?
Well, I would say it was just one of many interesting problems that Americans were working on. I would occasionally try to interest IBM people in the notion that you had so many stable states in a spin glass that maybe this was a good memory. But since I couldn't tell them how you were going to address a particular state or write a particular state in a controllable way, that never got off the ground. The year that the simulated annealing paper was published, and that was recognized fairly quickly as, oh, all right, that does make sense. That did convert a lot of people who felt that we were doing mathematically ugly things to recognize that the fact that while it took astronomical time, there was in fact a path to a ground state, and you could get there with the extra power of a slowly modulated temperature. That made it a problem that had a proof of a solution, and therefore it was acceptable. So I put together a talk on simulated annealing and went essentially everywhere. I gave more than one talk a month for a year. I would say that was the piece of work that was widely accepted in the United States.
So during your time at IBM and later on now at Hebrew U, did you ever get to teach a class about, about RSB and spin glasses?
Not about RSB, but I got to, I taught a little bit about optimization. I would teach a special class in an overall course on combinatorial methods, but I joined a department that had Nati Lineal, Avi Vigdorson, Noam Nissan, and a whole bunch of people that you may not know. So what I ended up teaching once I came here, not just on sabbatical, was project methodology. You know, how to create a project, what it's like to release a product, how to test usability. And so I ran this course for half a dozen years, and it rather quickly moved into it was an early entrepreneurial course in doing something that would make a difference and that people would care about. And it involved as the material, basically everybody had to do a simple project. I'm back to doing that to this day because my current responsibility is the final thesis of all of our engineering students, which is a project done in a small team. So we did that. We formed small teams and did little projects. Over time, we discovered that the piece of technology that they most needed to learn was, first of all, how to build a website. That got to be too easy. Then how to program a smartphone, which very rapidly moved from the barely programmable in Java, flip phones, to today's smartphones. And so the course continues to be taught, but by other people who are more interested than me in exposing our students to the programming systems that let you build apps. And you build apps out of apps nowadays rather than raw code.
So is there anything else you would like to share with us about that epoch that we may have skipped over or missed that were particularly important?
Well, I've always felt that science was supported in the US for its ability to make us a national power, for its World War II success in super weapons, and super this and super that. but kind of with a slightly military flavor, always on the edge of the military. When I got to Europe and looked for funding for projects there, it was always much more European commercial viability, European commercial success. And the nice thing was that optimization and understanding we worked for a couple of years in understanding, mapping and understanding the topology of the internet, using some of the same ideas that had come out of percolation and conduction in percolation and the flows through random lattices, random graphs, really. Because those were the things that would help Europe compete, not very successfully, if I may say so, with the Google and the Amazons of the world that were most successfully putting themselves everywhere in the internet.
I see. Francesco, did you have any question that?
No, thank you.
Thank you. So in the final question is, do you still have notes, paper, correspondence from that epoch? And if you do, do you have any plans to deposit them at an academic archive?
Gosh, I wish I could, but I would need help extracting them. First of all, when I left IBM, I only took a laptop stuffed with files with me. I didn't really take all my emails. And they were in a system that, an IBM script system that I don't think I could run anymore. So I don't know where those are. And then I, up until around 2008, I used an email system that I abandoned for Gmail at that time. And so everything's been in Gmail since then. And so I really only have about 10 or 15 years worth of email to which I have access. And I brought along all my old papers, in a couple of large cardboard boxes. They'd filled a couple of file cabinets. So, recently I was reading a book by a book called Yes, But, or Yes, If Then. What's her name? She writes for The New Yorker. She's a professor at Harvard, and she cranks out at least one book a year.
Yes.
What she was doing was talking about the history of the very first election predictors, and the kind of they were brave enough to call it AI, but it really was a very simplistic modeling that they used to predict the outcome of elections and to tailor a politician's message to predicting whether it would or would not influence the voters that they thought they should get or that they wanted to bring together into a majority. And what struck me was that the piece of AI and prediction and machine learning that I was witness to during that time was Bernie Woodrow and Jeff Hinton and very simple few-layer neural networks, all of which was exiled, driven to the AI winter of failure by people like Marvin Minsky, who proved to his satisfaction that it couldn't work because he showed that a single layer network couldn't capture XOR. These brilliant assholes respected in their community wrote an entire book on the failure of neural networks to provide a jumping off point for machine learning. It cost us 10 years. Meanwhile, Bernie Woodrow was doing multi-layer networks out at Stanford, which back in then was the outer, was the Siberia of American academia. And his stuff works and continues to work. And it took about a 10-year period of the PTP community pursuing neural networks, even though they didn't work, like bumblebees, to make stuff which ultimately became the foundation of deep networks, which worked even though my work on simulated annealing also showed that you shouldn't be able to get there because there ought to be all these traps at higher energies that would keep you from finding the true ground state. And what was discovered in the course of if you like, bumblebees doing their bumblebee thing was that there aren't that many higher energy states that will trap you. And there are so many solutions that could be used that you didn't need to get there anyway. So how's that for wrapping up all of the things we've learned from spin glasses?
So as a final note, I'd like to say that if you do have paper correspondence from that you brought with you from the 70s and 80s, I would definitely encourage you to deposit those.
Who wants it and will take it and will keep it in a way that is usable?
Well, you should talk to the Hebrew U first and foremost, right? That's where you are.
And we have a library which was so dead. We have a lovely library in the middle of our campus. The computer science building used to be right next to it. It was so dead, it hired nobody in 18 years. And so when I got here, I wrote a list of things that I'm interested in, one of which is, how will we archive born digital information? And the library agreed, people at our library agreed that that's a very interesting topic. But then they had so little money from the university that they couldn't hire anybody to work on it. We had a small library school, which we got rid of because it wasn't in Harvard's terms, it was every tub on their own bottom, on its own bottom. This tub wasn't floating, it was sinking. And so we closed the library school and we are now building an absolutely gorgeous national library. Our library used to be called the National Library. And so all of the new emphasis in libraries has moved to just outside the Hebrew University campus and across the street from the Knesset. So I don't believe we have a good place for the Scott Kirkpatrick archive to go. But in the book, If Then, a lot of the stuff that she got to and could base her work on was Ithiel de Sala Poole, was the guy doing political projection and political mapping and political AI at that time. He did it at MIT and he did leave an archive which she used to get her book started as a basis for much of her book. I'll think of her name when we're finished, but you can probably find it from the title of the book. And de Sala Poole did leave an archive. And so a lot of stuff about the increasing sophistication and the increasing intellectual content of what were the underpinnings that you could do this with is in that archive. And it also did not progress very far during that time, largely because the title of this book reflects the structure of a decision tree. If a person recognizes that you're against abortion, that puts them in a subcategory of the decision tree. And then you can ask another question. And if you've gotten a yes to two or three of those questions, you have a voter and maybe you can sign that person up to go out and get more voters. But what they didn't do was go off axis to go into multi-dimensional analysis. And Widrow was there. Minsky wasn't there because he was on axis. And all of the work in deep learning recognizes that you have the possibility of, by going to nonlinear and off axis high dimensional spaces, you have a far richer world. It's not a curse of dimensionality, it's the power of dimensionality to get you out to where these things can be really captured. to where clusters form and things really can be captured. And it was the one insight that's missing from this rather stimulating book about the mathematization and the computerization of political intelligence. And it's missing because de Salapool didn't recognize it, and it wasn't in his bag of tricks. Minsky didn't realize that he'd left it out. And Bernie Woodrow didn't know that he was doing it. And until people like Jeff Hinton and later Jan LeCun and the Carnegie Mellon crowd came along and formed the PTP collaboration, which produced a couple of books in the very early 2000s, I guess, or maybe mid 1990s, which made all of that accessible as a playpen that you could really do stuff in. So that's existing. It has a rather similar trajectory to spin glasses, but it didn't ever develop replicas.
Scott,
okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.